House Transportation will come to order and welcome everybody. I think we're going to go ahead and get started on our informational meeting, and hopefully members will trickle in at some point. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on an informational hearing, sorry, on Oregon Metropolitan Planning Organizations. And OMPOC is the acronym that you'll remember for the rest of your lives after this meeting.
Chair Beyer, committee members, thank you for seeing us this afternoon. I'm Michael Quilty. I'm a city councilman in Central Point, Oregon, and I also have the pleasure of chairing the Rogue Valley Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is one of the six MPOs in Oregon. And we have a presentation, if the projector will come up here, that we'll go through. And I also have representatives from each of the six MPOs in the state here with us today. And when we get to the area that of the presentation that is particular to each MPO, I'll have a representative from that MPO tell you a little something about them.
Thank you.
We're very committed at the MPOs to work very cooperatively together among the six of us to share things together. We share our solutions on how to address problems, best solutions, and how to maximize the scarce dollars that come to us in these troubled times. So you might want to know what an MPO is. MPOs were created by Congress for sharing federal resources and doing local regional planning on how to spend federal transportation dollars in a local region. They're designated by the governor and are staffed and run by regionally elected representatives and local staff. There are 55 local representatives that make from all six of the MPOs that make up OMPOC here in Oregon. Where are we located? There's Portland Metro, which is probably the one that you folks here are most familiar with. Salem-Keizer, Corvallis, Bend, Eugene-Springfield, and then the Rogue Valley Medford-Ashland area. MPOs have developed a 20 to 25 year regional transportation plan, and we identify funding and we set regional transportation priorities, and we demonstrate our ability to meet our air quality obligations under federal regulations. And in the present legislation that you folks have looked at, we also want you to know that we support the proposed review of how the state develops its STIP, and we are very committed to being a committed partner to see that that goes forward in the future. Some facts about our MPOs. Two-thirds of the citizens of Oregon live inside the boundaries of an MPO. Almost 800,000 of us are outside of the Portland metro area. We cover 43 cities and 17 of the 20 largest cities inside the state of Oregon. We are an economic engine for Oregon's present and its future. We're transportation and economic hubs, and most of the growth in Oregon's economy recently has taken place inside the boundaries of the six MPOs. We have a lot of challenges that face us, as everyone does currently, with our funding solutions that we have in front of us currently, and we're committed to taking and working together to make our dollars go as far as possible. We have been a source of very rapid growth in the last decade, anywhere from about 20% to 142% growth in the last decade in these six regions. So, as I said, we are definitely where the economy of Oregon is happening at the present time. We're committed to keeping our economy competitive and making major transportation investments with local, regional, and federal funds. We also want to let you know that we want to make sure that our ability to take and raise local funds is not preempted or put on hold. That our ability to take and raise local funds is very important because a growing amount of the projects that we're doing in our areas are being done with local funds because the federal share has declined in recent years. We're also a source of goods movement in Oregon. And we are very pleased with what we've been able to do with Connect Oregon, Connect Oregon 2, and we're firm supporters of Connect Oregon 3. And we would want to note that congestion in our areas, which is something that we're committed to doing something about, has a huge effect on our economy. As congestion grows, we see delivery trucks making fewer deliveries each day. We're seeing increases in travel time and a decrease in the reliability of transportation that delivers goods to our citizens. There we go. We also are finding that we can help you address climate change. In our area, transportation accounts for approximately a third of all greenhouse gases. In our area, that is significantly higher than it is in the rest of the nation, basically due to the fact that so much of our electrical energy in the West is produced by hydroelectric versus coal-powered power plants. So transportation and its effect on our communities will have a large impact on how we address greenhouse gas reduction going forward. We need stable funding. We face increasing maintenance costs. We find facility expansion does not keep pace with the growth of our community. Inflation has decreased the power of the gas tax revenue to pay for the things that we do every day. And we've also found that neighboring states are using other taxes to augment their transportation funds. Oregon has seen a shortfall in state revenue for transportation. And OMPOC sent forth a resolution earlier this year that showed over $600 million that we believe is desperately needed to address transportation funding shortfalls inside of the six MPOs. MPOs and the Oregon solution. Well, MPOs do bring solutions. Metro is the only MPO in the state that currently can take and directly affect land use. The other MPOs do not have the ability to make land use decisions. So we have to work cooperatively with the communities that we represent to get them to make effective use of their land as we go forward in the future, moving towards a balanced transportation and land use system. There are several things that are in the current transportation bill that we would like to emphasize. Going forward with looking for the studies on best practices, co-location of maintenance facilities, the review of responsibility between the stakeholders in transportation decisions, and support of fund flexibility. And we want to take and share a little something with you. MPOs service a much greater area than we actually taking cover with our individual boundaries. And we have a series of slides coming up. They're going to show what our travel sheds are around our regions. And they go out to what a 45-minute commute is in each area and what sort of communities are there. So we're going to go forward and bring those up. So here's the area around Bend. So
I'm Tyler Deakey, the manager for the Bend MPO. And what you're seeing is, as Mike mentioned, we've developed a series of travel shed maps. The Bend MPO boundary is only slightly larger than the city of Bend's urban growth boundary, but we have a travel shed that's obviously significantly bigger and captures almost every community within the Central Oregon area. Some of the issues that we're facing in our area include a significant backlog of preservation needs. We have a lot of work occurring locally right now to try and address that with local funding options. Given that large travel shed in our area, providing stable funding for travel options and regional transit opportunities is critical for our area. And something else of critical concern to us is access to our many shovel-ready industrial sites that are located up and down US 97. We have sites in Lapine, Bend, Redmond, and Madras that are all could be developed and provide job opportunities, but because of constraints on the highway system, some of those areas are not able to be developed today. I'll hand it off to you, Mike.
Okay. Thank you. This slide shows the travel shed for the Rogue Valley area. And the small dotted blue line there actually is the MPO. And as you can see, we go 60 miles down to Yreka in Montague, California, and up to north of Grants Pass for people that commute daily into the Medford-Ashland area for work. And our airshed is greatly affected by the number of people that commute into the Rogue Valley that live a significant distance from the actual MPO. We have critical needs for our short line rail connections in southern Oregon. The connection over the Siskiyous has been discontinued, and the amount of freight that's going north has gone down, and a significant number of trucks now have been added to the I-5 corridor, bringing timber products up from the Yreka area for the mills to use in the Medford area. And our transit system has a very large shortfall of $160-some million over the next 25 years, and their need to provide handicapped and disabled and elderly transport has severely impacted their ability to provide fixed route transit, with the result that they have reduced the number of routes that they have for fixed routes in the last 2 years. And if they can't find a stable funding source in the near future, they'll be looking at further cuts. And that doesn't include what we need to do for providing construction projects in the area to address congestion. So,
Hi.
Carlita.
I'm Carlotta Collette. I'm a Metro Councilor from District 2 in the Portland Metro Region, and I'm also Chair of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, better known as JPACT, for the Metro Region. And I wanted to point out in your packets, you have these fold-out, these little folders that we put together that illustrate each of the MPO regions, and the one I wanted to talk about is the North Willamette Valley region, which is this large area, and it includes both the Portland metro region and the Salem-Keizer region. In the Portland metro area, you're probably familiar with some of the issues that we have, a few notable bridges that you hear from time to time. We're looking at a $5.5 billion shortfall on road-related construction projects. We're also looking at a 25-year transit capital shortfall of more than $1 billion, and frankly, I'm working right now on the high-capacity transit study for the region for the next 35 years, and I can tell you the shortfall is going to be considerably higher than $1.2 billion. And our citizens are more and more asking us to expand the transit system and give them more choices other than just driving their vehicles to and from work. So we're looking at a number of multimodal solutions, transit being one of the most obvious. And of course, if you travel around the metro region, you know about our bottlenecks, our I-5, 205, also 217, and then when you get into downtown Portland, there's a whole other set of bottlenecks. So we have some serious constraints that we're facing, but we're also working, as all the MPOs are, we work very well collaboratively, and I think that y'all need to recognize in the MPOs a source of support for you, but also a way of kind of offloading some of the work of ODOT onto the people who are in the regions doing the work on the ground. And here to speak on the Salem-Keizer MPO.
Marcia Kelly, I'm president of the Salem-Keizer Transit Board and representing the Salem-Keizer Area Transportation Study Group, the elected officials in the Salem-Keizer area. You all drive to Salem, or are in Salem on a daily basis when you're in session. And so you probably know some of the things that are in need of funding. Projected is about a $311 million highway system, an I-5 shortfall, a potential bridge across the Willamette River in Salem that is estimated to cost about $600 million, connecting I-5 and coastal communities and decreasing the congestion there. Freeway interchanges that are needed for regional development, and then a shortfall over 25 years of about $244 million for the transit system. To give you an idea and just to tag along, the elderly and disabled transportation is, yes, one of the things that has created funding shortfalls. In Salem-Keizer, over the last 2 years, we've cut 27% of our fixed route service due to our shortfall. So we are looking for some increased stable funding for operations. Our federal funds, our stimulus funds, and our Connect Oregon funds can only be spent on capital projects. And for Salem and for the majority of the other transit systems in the state, we're desperately needful of the operations, the thing that puts the driver behind the wheel so that the driver can take 40 or 45 people to a destination in a transit bus.
Thank you. We have a question here, Representative Boone.
Before you leave, Marcia, thanks, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if my geography is wrong, but I am from a coastal community, and I can't quite make the connection to the Willamette River or I-5 from the coast.
You would if you went out to Lincoln City. It through 1822.
Yeah,
goes out to Lincoln City and then Nesquin, et cetera.
I'm aware of that, but I don't understand the new $600 million Willamette River Bridge needed to connect I-5 to the community.
It's an alternate that could be used for some people coming out of the Portland Travel Shed, the Southern Travel Shed, as well as connecting the coastal Lincoln City, Newport, Nesquin, all of those areas, over to the valley, oftentimes for medical services, et cetera.
I don't understand the bridge piece. I'm very well aware of those roads. The very bottom end of my district is Nesquin and does connect to as a lateral arterial to I-5, but I'm not getting the need for the bridge to connect the coast.
Can we have Representative Berger here.
Oh, okay.
Post Bridge is right in the middle of my district. Let me explain it to you if I could. The problem is that all transportation systems between I-5 and the Central Coast go right through downtown Salem, including all the truck traffic, which totally balls everybody up. During traffic times, the trucks just know not to go through. They won't get through in any timely fashion. So what's been on the table for quite a while, and of course nobody has this kind of money, so it gets delayed, is a different routing and a new bridge that doesn't go right through the middle of downtown Salem, so that folks coming off of I-5 could basically bypass all of that traffic and get commerce moving through. It would be a great transportation hub for the Central Valley. I will also tell you that my daughter, who lives in North Portland, who goes to the coast regularly, drives by way of Salem because she can't get there by way of Newburgh Dundee.
Okay. I see what you're saying now. Maybe you want to add the word Central Coast. It might help.
Okay.
Okay, we'll tell the people who prepared the slides. Next.
It's definitely a bridge to somewhere, though.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Evans, and I'm Vice President of Lane Transit District Board and a member of the Central Lane MPO. Talk to you a little bit about the Eugene Springfield MPO. Right now, we're facing a 20-year roadway construction shortfall of $300 million, as the slide indicates. We are in the process. I know in the city of Springfield right now there is a piece of initiative on the ballot to raise gas taxes in order to fund road construction in Springfield. We are facing some serious road issues all around the Central Lane area. We're looking to critical improvements required for the Beltline Road and interchanges along I-5. We just had the flyover, the first flyover that was, finished here back in the toward the end of last year, beginning of this year, and that's relieving some of our traffic congestion issues, but we're still facing quite a number of issues in that area as well. And then we are also looking to leverage funds for federal grants, particularly those grants that are focused on capital improvements for $142 million bus rapid transit system. We right now are in the second phase going into in implementing bus rapid transit in the Gateway area, and we are also working on a third line from downtown Eugene out to West Eugene. Eventually, the three lines that we will have up in probably the latter part of next decade will connect the Eugene-Springfield community all the way from the western end of Eugene through downtown Eugene and Springfield, and then out to North Springfield and along the Gateway corridor out there to the hospital, the new hospital site. So those are some of the issues that we're facing in the Eugene Springfield MPO, and thank you for your time. Any questions?
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ali Bonakhtar. I'm Director of Corvallis Area Metropolitan Planning Organizations. Our issues and needs are basically the same as the ones that previously stated by other members. We are in need of preservation dollars, and we have a backlog of maintenance and preservation in our area. We also are in need of capital dollars and capacity expansion type of dollars. Example of that is the Van Buren Bridge that we have. We have over there, the bridge was built in 1913, and we have a situation that three lanes merge into the one-lane bridge in downtown area. We haven't been able to come up with the necessary funding for replacement of this bridge and many other capital improvement projects. Other issues that we are dealing with is the boundaries and the regional issue, the fact that we have to plan for the entire travel shed, and Corvallis being an employment center because of the location of OSU, Hewlett-Packard, and other employment centers, we attract people from as far as Lebanon and many from Albany and other areas, yet Albany is not part of the MPO. And so that cuts into our ability to plan for the travel shed as opposed to, which is something that we have to do, but we are limited to the artificial boundaries of the MPO. Thank you for your time. Any questions?
Well, I guess I have a quick question, and you talk about the bridge that needs basically to be rebuilt. And have you looked at that? Do you know the actual, well, not the actual cost, but the area of the cost?
Well, we have done extensive studies for the a connection that move the downtown traffic across the river to the east. And we have reviewed options. One of those, we have three options. One is replacement of basically expanding the bridge, which would require a new bridge, and the cost of that new bridge is about $25 million right now. We have also the option of creating an interchange at the intersection right after the bridge on Highway 34. Where when you leave Corvallis, the first intersection, that is the cause of backup all the way into the downtown area. And turning that into a grade separation and interchange would resolve some of the backups and delays for downtown area. And the cost of that is probably $50 million. We also have looked at the option of having a north bypass, and that would be if you coming through Highway 34 to Corvallis, again, at the intersection before the bridge, you have the option of turning left and going south to Philomath and to the coast. This leg requires extension northward through the golf course, and to come across the river and connect with Highway 20 and Highway 99. And that's what we call the North Bypass. And that would leave basically all through traffic from downtown area, particularly the truck traffics that currently use our downtown area. And the cost of that is probably in the $80 million.
And
yeah.
And as you've looked at these, is there a preferred option at this point in time, or they're all?
Yes, ma'am. At this point, it is the decision to start with the interchange, first interchange, and maybe later on thinking about the replacement of the bridge. And the bridge, we had extensive public outreach, and it is the desire of people of Corvallis to maintain the existing Van Buren Bridge for pedestrian and bikes only, and build a new bridge with two lanes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any No other questions. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative.
I don't have any questions specifically of any of the MPOs.
Okay.
More comment than anything else. Is that okay? Is
sure.
that a good time? Actually, there's several things going on here. First of all, I support metropolitan planning organizations. Ever since I've been involved in public service, we clearly have a need and a demand, rightly so, for well-thought-out, well-planned, managed growth in land use and planned transportation to go with it. The seventh slide says MPOs are the transportation and economic hubs of the state economy. I have to take issue with that. The transportation and economic hubs of the state economy are within MPOs. MPOs themselves are not a transportation and economic hub. So, and words are important, and I just wanted to point that out. But also, you mentioned the need to haul logs up from Yreka, California, into Oregon for our mills to maintain.
No, it's timber products to come
timber
up.
Timber products.
Not logs.
Okay,
it
well,
is,
forgive me.
It's processed lumber.
Okay, you know what? Either way, we don't need any processed lumber from California. The problem in this state is, and I'm not blaming MPOs, the problem in this state is we can't do what we do best, and that is produce lumber products.
Oh.
And the reason, I'm not, but please, just stay with me here.
Yep.
It isn't MPO's fault, and I don't think for a large degree it's the state's fault. What I really, we used to be able to, we had a lot of money decades ago for education and roads because we were in our forests. And I think those folks that are elected to MPOs in their positions need to join people like me in lobbying our federal delegation to make sure that there's this, specifically, there's a renewable fuel bill in Washington, D.C. that specifically carves out wood fiber products. Now, that is just absurd. Our entire delegation in federal government should vote no on that. We should encourage them to get that amended. And if we're serious about, which I believe we all are, funding these transportation needs here in the state, that's where we can start, right there in the forest. So I just wanted that. But for the most part, I like what you're saying and doing here. Thank you for coming.
No. Our comment was that with the loss of the short line carrying those products
right.
over the Siskiyous, we've seen a huge increase in the number of trucks that are hauling those products, which are taking up the capacity of Interstate 5, where it used to go by rail, it's now going by truck. And that's a very inefficient use of a piece of infrastructure. And that's our concern, not the fact that the wood itself is being produced there. And I agree with you. Timber is something that Oregon knows how to do probably better than almost any other state in the nation, and it's a shame that we're not taking and maximizing it. And we have a group in the Rogue Valley that is currently working on using deadfall timber for energy production in a mobile process that they can take out to the forest and produce energy to power our factories and our homes. And if we take and remove that type of resource from our ability to use, we're cutting our nose off to spite our face.
And follow up on that?
Follow up.
We're cutting our nose off to spite our face if we import gravel, too.
Yeah. And we've just got a slide or two left. Understand, a lot of the names and numbers on these bills have changed, and the bill numbers themselves aren't important. It's the ideas that we want to get across that we support. We need to take and increase the amount that we charge ourselves in gas tax to take and pay for our infrastructure. We need to look at addressing funding increases for TPR, funding for multi-use trails, for non-motorized transportation uses, transportation for the elderly and disabled. We'd like to see or let you know that we support the inclusion of the four best practices studies in the bills, least cost planning, Connect Oregon 3, flexible funding mandates, We'd also like to see the greenhouse gas issues addressed, and we also like to know that as local representatives, we want to make sure that preempting our ability to raise local taxes to fund local projects is not taken away from us. If we don't have the ability to raise local dollars, we cannot get in line for federal money. If we don't have our own money to put up against federal money as a match, we can't get in line for that money, and it will go to somebody else. Please do not take away our ability to raise local money. If a local elected board or local citizens want to reach into their own pocket to take and pay for a local project, let them do so. We're seeing more and more of our transportation needs being funded out of local dollars with the shortfall in federal funding. And we need the ability to take and keep that whole. And with that, I want to thank you very, very much for giving us this time this afternoon. And if you have any questions of us, we'd be very happy to answer them.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you. I would ask that if those numbers have changed, that you let us know, because otherwise we will copy those numbers out of there and put stickies or whatever our source is in our bill files. And if you don't have a number, we can't possibly be asked to look that up,
and
the right one.
We will make sure that that information gets passed on to your support staff. We've included a package for you folks today. Inside of that, you'll find a list of the 12 MPO policy committee members from each of the six MPOs that make up the OMPOC board, a list of all 55 local elected officials that represent the MPO policy boards and the six MPOs, and they're also inside of them four flyers that have information on the six MPOs. We call them greater regions in this because we find that we influence areas significantly outside of our boundaries, and our travel sheds go way beyond the area that we have a mandate to cover, but those people work and shop and travel through our communities on a daily basis. And if you have further questions, please contact us at any time. We'll be happy to help you find the answers to them.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking through some of the slides here from the beginning and thinking through the stated roles and goals for MPOs, so you have a slide here on climate change, and I heard you reference it several times in your testimony, but I don't see it as listed as one of the roles for MPOs. Can you just relate for us the connection between the stated roles that you have here and how that connects to the climate change issue?
They're in some of the federal legislation that's coming up, they are looking at including greenhouse gases in emission standards. Recently, CO2 has been listed as something that the EPA will now have to take and look at. And transportation is a significant greenhouse gas generator in the Pacific Northwest. On the national average, transportation is about 17%. Because we get so much of our energy from hydroelectric plants on the West Coast, transportation ends up being about 33% to 34% of where greenhouse gases are generated in Oregon. And so our ability to address that from the transportation side is going to be tougher in Oregon than it would be on the East Coast. We have a bigger portion of that requirement that's going to be transportation. And we found that land use has a bigger effect on the generation of greenhouse gases and transportation than almost anything else. And currently, other than in the metro area, MPOs have to lead by example. We can't actually pass a land use regulation. We have to convince our members to make good land use decisions. And
if I may follow up as well, Carlotta Collette again from Metro. Portland's metro. We are actually also developing the modeling capability to be able to look at the transportation plan for our region from a greenhouse gas perspective. And as we develop that model, we'll be able to use that to help with the other MPOs doing their transportation planning. We actually did some scenarios last fall of kind of extreme cases of, if, for example, if all of our investment went into high-capacity transit and buses, if all of our investments went into highways, a number of different packages of investments, even with what we thought was the best package, with a lot of our investment, most of our investment going into high-capacity transit, we still did not reduce our greenhouse gases. So we as MPOs, because we have the capability more than rural communities have the most difficult time reducing greenhouse gases because they're linked almost always and only by cars. We have options in the metropolitan regions. We have transit. We have bike ped. So we have the capacity to have the biggest impact in the state on greenhouse gas reductions. But we need to be extremely aggressive about how we go about doing that. And it's not going to be easy. I mean, if the current RTP, the Regional Transportation Plan, that we're just finishing in the Portland metro region keeps us at about 1990 levels for greenhouse gases. As you know, the state has set goals of going to 20%, 50%, and 75% below 1990 levels in greenhouse gas emissions. So we have our work cut out for us, and electric cars will play a big role in that, in particularly, again, in the urban areas, in the MPOs, but also transit, multimodal, bikes, peds, getting people out of their cars as much as possible.
Oh, thank you. If I can perhaps see if I can characterize what I'm hearing here, I think we're all aware of the greenhouse gas challenges embedded within the transportation sector. What I'm hearing is that through the capacity of linking planning with transportation and land use, that you are planning for efficient movement of people, goods, and goods, and that in doing so, there is a secondary climate change benefit to that by ensuring that the right trips are made for the right reasons. But I don't see it specifically listed in your goals, or are you saying that it is actually a goal of MPOs to address greenhouse gas?
Well, it is one of our requirements is the Clean Air Act requirement. So air quality is one of the reasons that MPOs were created in the early 1960s legislation. That focus has been more about particulates and other kinds of air pollution until recently. Now we're recognizing that we also, especially by linking land use and transportation and multimodal, we can have a significant impact on the greenhouse gas issue as well.
So if there is a federal requirement that then CO2 is part of Clean Air Act requirements, then enabling MPOs to do this kind of planning puts us in the position of being able to more efficiently address those federal restrictions.
Yes.
Is that
absolutely
correct?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're trying to work to get out a little ahead of what the federal government is currently doing. They're looking at those things now. They have not formalized those rules. And so for the last couple of years, MPOs in Oregon and AMPO, the Association of MPOs at the national level, have been looking across the nation at what different things MPOs can do to reduce greenhouse gas emission production within our boundaries. And one of the things that works very, very well is linking land use and transportation so that you put high density populations and trip generators on corridors that can handle high-density transportation, and building communities in such a way that transit is an effective option for those who wish to use it. And it's a synergy of things. There isn't any one perfect answer. It's going to take doing a lot of little different steps along the way to try and get a melding of the whole.
Thank you. Representative Gilman, Schaffler, and then Widener.
Mike?
Yes,
thank you for presenting today. Always good to see somebody from Southern Oregon.
No, happy to be here.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Yeah, I moved here in 88 and got heavily involved in 96, and I will say my Metropolitan Planning Organization, I've been involved in that as well. As a matter of fact, I've said this before, I was Carl Rohde's alternate to JPAC back in the 90s when I was on City Council. Well, this all costs money, and you're doing a good job. We actually have done a great job in reducing miles traveled, getting moving smarter, and giving alternatives in the Portland area. And I commend everybody for that. What I would like, but I'm a dog with a bone. If you hang out in this building long enough, you're going to find out recurring theme coming out of my mouth. My request to you is if you have a database like this that I could put in a mail merge, but with all these addresses on it as well, because I want to contact each and every one of these people and ask them, just all the things we talk about here I want to do, but it all costs money. And what does Oregon do well? What do we do better than anyone else in the world? And you said it. We grow trees. Every one of these people need to call their federal delegate and their senator and say, we need wood fiber back in that bill. It belongs in that bill. It's going to help us fix our transportation problems. It's going to help us fund our education. It's going to help us manage our forests. It's going to help us avoid incredible damaging to property and human life forest fires. And it just makes perfect sense. A certain percentage, don't ask me what, goes to transportation. It's just criminal that we don't have, and that 800,000 people that are outside MPOs, they're already able and willing to go out there and do this and help us solve our metropolitan transportation problems. Not because they're nice, because they want to make a living too. So it's if you have that database, and I wanted it as soon as you can get it, because I'm having a letter drafted that I'm going to ask my colleagues to sign, to send to our delegation in Washington as well.
Yeah, we can.
We have it. We can get it to you.
We can get it from the MPO's executive directors and get it forwarded.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wideman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the greenhouse gases and that end. Just going through and looking at things, I see a lot of things where we're looking at encouraging people to go to electric cars, to go and ride mass transit, different things like that. But one thing, and one of the benefits we have sitting here, is we get to hear testimony from lots of different people over the session. And one thing we did have ODOT come in here and say is, by putting in the weigh-in-motion scales for trucks, it reduced pollution by 60% from them not stopping. Yet I don't see a lot where we're addressing bottlenecks in here, because our biggest pollution is bottlenecks on our highway and transportation system. And one of the things we talk about is a 12-lane bridge, things like that. Well, it doesn't do us any good to have 12 lanes of bridge if we're going back down to 3 lanes of highway or 6 lanes of highway. So I don't know if we're looking at adding more lanes to our highway infrastructure and using Oregon gravel for that and Oregon timber.
Actually, we've done some analysis in the in the Portland metro region as part of this current planning process, looking at intelligent transportation systems, traffic management systems, an investment in technology like the weighing in motion, synchronizing lights, signalize. There's a number of very low-cost things that you can do that have huge impacts on flow-through of traffic for far less than adding a lane of highway. What happens is, and I know you all know this, especially if you've been hearing from people from around the state, when you add lanes of freeway, you do not really reduce congestion. The congestion is reduced very short-term. What happens is people move onto those lanes, they get filled up again. So you're really just creating new capacity, unless you have the other options to get people out of their cars. But really, the least cost approach is what we're learning in the Portland area, is that we can make, and we've done a very detailed analysis. We have now what's called a mobility atlas of corridors, and we look at what are the bottlenecks in every corridor in the metropolitan area, major corridors, what are the cheapest things we can do to relieve those bottlenecks, and that includes changing signalization, sometimes adding different kinds of traffic lanes. I think one of the things they're looking at nationwide, not as much yet in our region, is adding, having lanes, not adding lanes, but creating lanes on existing lanes that are freight only, for example, or HOT lanes that are toll or high capacity lanes, HOV type lanes. So there are a lot of things that you can do that don't cost the same as adding a lane of to increase the capacity in roads. And we're looking at that as well as the places where we have bottlenecks, where we know we are going to have to do some expansion. But I think region-wide, that's a lower priority than doing the most efficient things we can first.
Yeah.
So we don't have any money to add lanes.
Yeah, and one of the other things is the major focus for transportation for MPOs are non-highway projects. The highway projects are actually handled by ODOT, and they bring them to us, and we include them in our regional transportation plan, but those are planned and carried out for the great part by ODOT and not necessarily, particularly by the smaller MPOs. They're not something that we have anywhere near the type of financing to address, though they're something that we're very, very aware of. And most of the shortfalls that we mention are things in our transportation plans are those fixes for our bottlenecks in our local street network so that we can move people around the floor of our metropolitan areas in a much more efficient manner.
Follow-up, did you? You're okay. Representative Shafton.
Thank you. I support the alternatives, buses, MACs, bicycle, walking, the vehicle-mized travel, the way in motion, these lanes where you have commuters and more than one HOV, I think you said, what that stands for. I support all of that as long as we have a 12-lane bridge going across the river.
Mm-hmm. I have an interesting statistic for you. We've started building, after World War II, we built different communities than we built before World War II. And they've done a study in the last year or so. And if you live in a community that was designed and built prior to World War II versus one that was built after 1950, as an adult American male, because it's a walkable community, you weigh on the average 10 pounds less. And 6 pounds less...
Is that directed right at me, Matt?
No. I'm a perfect example of that because I live in a...
You're looking good,
I'm looking in a neighborhood that was built in 1995, so I'm packing those extra pounds around because to get to my local grocery store, I've got to get in my car because it's 2.5 miles away from my house. I can't walk to my grocery store like you used to be able to do in your old downtown neighborhoods. And we used to build communities where you could walk places, and we did. And we had electric trolleys that connected our suburbs to our downtown core. My grandfather was a Bell Lab engineer. He lived in West Orange, New Jersey, which was a very blue-collar neighborhood, and commuted in to Bell Labs in downtown New York City because he could ride the bus, catch the train, and take the ferry across the river and then walk 2 blocks to his office. And he did that until the 1960s when they built Bell Labs' big research campus out in Trenton, near Trenton, New Jersey. And people said, "Why do you live there?" And he said, "I don't need a car." He didn't buy a car until my mother went to college in the 1950s. And it's because he had a neighborhood that worked for him without an automobile. And we don't design our cities that way anymore.
I support all that as long as we have a 12-lane bridge.
Yes. Well, I tell you what, I drove my Yukon to get here, so I understand that.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm glad we were able to schedule us on the day you were in the area. I don't know if you're in the building or you're...
Well, it's a little of that, and like I said, I want you folks to realize, we didn't ask you guys for a dollar today. We mentioned areas we have problems. We want you to know that we're a resource to work with you to find solutions. We find that MPOs can oftentimes do transportation projects significantly cheaper than you can if you federalize the project. If we do it as a local project, we save 20% to 30% over doing it as a federal project. And that's one of the reasons why local money is so important to us. We can build significantly more when we do it locally.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I'm going to close the informational hearing. And I'm going to open up a hearing on Senate Bill 129A. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, it came to us from the Senate where it was approved on a 26-3 vote. The measure increases penalties for violation of Oregon ODOT out-of-service orders. It increases suspension of commercial driver licenses for first violations of out-of-service orders and increases penalties on employers of commercial motor vehicle operators who violate out-of-service orders if the employer knowingly allows a violation. Prohibits ODOT from issuing a commercial driver license with a hazardous materials endorsement to individuals, foreign citizens, or legal residents that make changes related to commercial driving regulations. And this measure, Madam Chair, has an emergency clause that would take effect upon signature by the governor.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to call Tom McClellan forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 129A. The bill proposes statutory changes needed to comply with federal laws and regulations needed for the driving privileges of commercial motor vehicle operators. Additional changes include clarification of existing laws and removal of inconsistent language. The bill also gives the department authority to cancel a farm endorsement if a person's CDL, commercial driver license, is suspended or revoked for two or more of the offenses described in ORS 809-404, or if the driver is convicted of a crime punishable as a felony involving use of any vehicle in the manufacturing, distributing, or dispensing of a controlled substance. A little background of the commercial.
Madam Chair, yes. Can I get Tom to speak right into the microphone?
You bet.
Thank you.
A little background, the Commercial Motor Vehicle Safety Act of 19, hope you can understand that.
Okay. It's better.
The Commercial Motor Vehicle Safety Act of 1986 established national standards for commercial motor vehicle operators to achieve greater consistency among the states for the purpose of reducing truck and bus crashes. Each state administers their own CDL program based on federal laws and regulations that set those standards for testing and licensing of commercial motor vehicle operators. The CDL program also disqualifies CMV drivers that fail to meet the standards or commit specific offenses identified in federal regulations and in Oregon statutes. The FMCSA regulates commercial motor vehicle operators' operations under the authority of the Department of Transportation, the U.S. Department of Transportation. Among other responsibilities, they ensure compliance with commercial driver license standards for drivers, motor carriers, and the states. Those standards are specified in federal regulations that are revised and updated frequently. It seems that every session we bring a bill like this before you to align our state laws with the federal laws and regulations. Failure to comply with those regulations can jeopardize full allocation of federal funding. For example, we have the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, the grant money, about $2.4 million annually, including about $1.5 million allocated to the Oregon State Police. In addition, FMCSA can withhold 5% of federal aid highway funds for the first year of noncompliance, up to 10%, or about $26 million, in each subsequent year for noncompliance. Worst case scenarios, we could be decertified and not be able to issue a commercial driver license to Oregon citizens. So there's a hammer there. There's requirements, and there's also a penalty for noncompliance. What I have a section-by-section description for you, and I'd be willing to go through that if you would like. This is just background on what the bill does. I'll proceed. Section 2 deals with farm endorsements. In 2007, the legislature gave us the department authority to impose CDL suspensions for drivers who operate commercial motor vehicles under a farm endorsement. This was done in response to a compliance review or an audit that was done in 2004. This bill goes one step further and proposes to cancel the farm endorsement when a driver's CDL is disqualified for two or more offenses described in ORS 809-404 such as driving under the influence of intoxicants, failure to perform the duties of a driver, any crime punishable as a felony involving a motor vehicle, or any degree of murder, manslaughter, or criminally negligent homicide. We believe it's good public policy that persons who are disqualified from operating CMVs for these types of offenses should not be allowed to operate a CMV for farm endorsement under a farm endorsement authority. So that's Section 2. Sections 3 and 7 deal with gross vehicle weight rating and the actual gross combination weight. Except for drivers who have a farm endorsement, a CDL is required to operate a commercial motor vehicle in Oregon. The current definition of a commercial motor vehicle includes a gross vehicle weight rating of 26,001 pounds or more, as specified by the manufacturer. Under current Oregon statutes, a driver could load a vehicle with a rating less than 26,001 pounds to a weight that exceeds that and not be required to possess a CDL. Under proposed regulations from the FMCSA, the definition of a CMV would include GVWR or actual gross weight, whichever is greater. The definition proposed in Senate Bill 129 mirrors the federal language and will discourage overloading of lighter vehicles to avoid the CDL requirements. Sections 3 and 7 deal with mass transit vehicles. They remove language inadvertently left in statute from 2007. References to mass transit vehicles were inadvertently left in the definition of a commercial motor vehicle. We believe the legislature intended to stop requiring the CDL for operators of mass transit vehicles except when the vehicle exceeds 26,001 pounds or carries more than 16 passengers. However, the remaining language should be removed because it could be interpreted to require a CDL whenever a mass transit vehicle is operated regardless of its vehicle size or the passenger capacity. Sections 4 and 5 deal with the definition of to hold a CDL. Federal regulations define when a CDL disqualification is necessary and prohibit deferring convictions or allowing diversions for a person who holds a CDL. Oregon law currently has the phrase hold a valid CDL as prescribed by federal regulations, but the word valid has led to some different interpretations within the court system in Oregon. In one case, a judge allowed diversion of a CDL holder because the driver's medical certificate had expired. The Oregon Supreme Court rejected that argument and ruled that under current law, an invalid medical certificate does not automatically invalidate a CDL. Nevertheless, in this bill, we're proposing to change the definition, hold a CDL, by deleting the term valid to avoid potential misinterpretations and a violation of federal regulations. This provision has an emergency clause effective upon passage. Section 6 deals with military purposes. Under federal regulations, anyone who operates a CMV for military purposes is exempt from CDL requirements. Currently, Oregon's law improperly limits this exemption by requiring the driver have an out-of-state license or a permit issued by the armed forces. This section removes those conditions in compliance with the federal regulations. Section 8 deals with hazardous materials endorsement. Federal regulations require an applicant for a hazardous materials endorsement to provide proof of U.S. citizenship or lawful permanent residence in the United States. Under current law in Oregon, an applicant must prove permanent or temporary legal residence as part of a federal Transportation Security Administration, TSA, background check. This section removes eligibility for those individuals with a temporary lawful status in the United States. Section 9 deals with suspension lengths. In 2007, the duration of a driver's license suspension for failure to appear or failure to comply for a non-CDL driver were increased to 10 years or until they comply, whichever is earlier. Those same changes were not made to the CDL statutes. This section increases the CDL suspensions for failure to appear and failure to comply to 10 years or until compliance, which achieves consistency with the non-CDL suspensions. The duration of the CDL suspension for violating an out-of-service order or notice also was increased to comply with the federal regulations. That would go from 90 days to 180 days for first violation. Section 9 is the conviction definition. This section adds a definition for conviction that aligns with the federal regulations. A recent audit finding by FMCSA indicated that Oregon must define conviction as it pertains to a CDL disqualifying offense. The definition used by FMCSA ensures that states have authority to disqualify the CMV operators or CDL holders for all offenses described in federal regulations. They have insisted in their audits that the ordinary definition of a conviction does not address all the potential offenses that would require disqualification. For example, the ordinary definition does not include failure to appear in court for a summons or the failure to pay a fine or court costs. They believe that this creates the possibility of a driver challenging a disqualification on the basis that he or she was not convicted and may not be disqualified under Oregon law. The department believes it has sufficient authority to suspend drivers who commit these offenses within Oregon, but may not have that same authority for some offenses that occur outside the state. Therefore, the conviction definition used by FMCSA and incorporated into Senate Bill 129 only applies to CMV or CDL offenses that occur outside of Oregon. Section 10 deals with law enforcement authority. Law enforcement officials have questioned their statutory authority to cite an out-of-state CMV operator for driving while suspended or revoked when the CDL is suspended or revoked in a state other than Oregon. Instead, officers may cite the driver for operating without driving privileges. However, a conviction for operating without driving privileges does not result in a federally mandated CDL disqualification like driving while suspended or revoked. This section specifies that the offense of driving while suspended or revoked includes operating a commercial motor vehicle in Oregon while driving privileges are suspended or revoked in any state. This change ensures that law enforcement can properly cite these drivers and that the federally mandated CDL disqualification will be imposed. Finally, sections 11, 12, 14, and 15 all deal with out-of-service orders. Law enforcement may prohibit operation of a CMV by issuing a vehicle or a driver out-of-service order if it's determined the vehicle or driver is in violation of applicable safety standards or laws. FMCSA regulations increase the mandatory civil penalties and commercial driver license suspension periods for violating these out-of-service orders in July of 2007. These sections raise the penalties in Oregon to match the minimum federal requirement and remove redundant and incorrect penalty language from the current statutes. So in summary, the changes proposed in Senate Bill 129A are necessary to bring Oregon into compliance with federal laws and regulations. The changes reduce the risk of losing federal highway funds. They clarify confusing statutes and remove statutory inconsistencies. Passage of this bill also enhances public safety, and we request your support of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Gilman, and then Spence.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Gotta watch when you go ahead.
Okay. Tom, the out-of-service order, you've raised from 11,000 to 25,000. Because that's what the feds want?
Yes. I'm
it
sure
seems like an awfully big increase.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, it is the maximum that we can assess by the federal regulations to an employer for those out-of-service violations. So we just, when they point that out in their audits that the Oregon law isn't consistent with the regulations, we just need to bring that up to that level. It's a maximum. It's not a given that every time someone would receive that. It's a range of what the penalty could be assessed.
Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 11, paragraph, or section 14, line 15, it says, for purposes of this section, notification may include. Why is that a may? Are there other means of notification that the department could accept? I'm just worried about a telephone call or something of that nature. Is that what? Is that why that is a may as opposed to a will, does, must?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I believe that's true. I'm not really sure if a shall would be appropriate there, but we have tried to align this with the federal regulations. So we tried to keep it as broad as we can within the limits of the regulations.
My other question is similar to Representative Gilman's, and is the five-year increase to 10 is a direct follow parallel to the federal law also?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? None. Thank you. And stick around in case we have any follow-up. And I'm going to call Sean Cleave and Jeff Stone up. Welcome, gentlemen.
Brett Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau, testifying today on behalf regarding Senate Bill 129. I'm going to limit my testimony only to Section 2 of the bill because that is the section that is of some concern to Oregon Farm Bureau. This section was described as the two strikes provision that would bring Oregon farm-endorsed holders under the same standard as Oregon CDL holders for purposes of a variety of frankly, a fairly horrific list of infractions. And taken together, it definitely is one of those issues that is somewhat difficult to pass the red face test regarding testimony in opposition. However, our biggest concern with that is that for purposes of CDL holders, if they were brought under the provisions of this bill, we would have situations where small Oregon operators, farmers and vendors, as a good example has been given, that would have the potential for a different standard that would have serious ramifications on their ability to make a living. Specifically, the classification of the DUII under the federal standards for CDL holders. And that is lower. That's half of what the current infraction would be. So if you blew a .04 for a CDL, you would be driving under the influences. Now, there are a variety of situations where many farmers, particularly vinters, it may be easy for them to hit that .04 rate. Also, under this provision, there would be no difference between being on the job and off the job. So if you were out with some friends, were pulled over, and you were under the impression that you were fine as long as you only had one drink an hour, the theory being one drink an hour will keep you under that .08 limit, suddenly you would probably, to your shock, find out that you were guilty of driving DUII. Also under this new standard in Section 2, you wouldn't be eligible for diversion, and you would have a suspension for as many as 10 years. So I would describe that as somewhat of a nuclear option for a group of people who don't actually rely on driving as 100% of their profession, such as a CDL holder would. Now, many Oregon Farm Bureau members do hold CDLs, and many of them drive truck in the off-season to supplement their income. So the question becomes the difference between CDL holders and Class C driver's license holders with farm endorsements. I think it's important to point out that it's not a farm license. It's an endorsement that's attached to either a CDL or a Class C driver's license. I'd also like to point out, just for the record, that this is Section 2 of the bill is the only section that doesn't have federal monies tied to it or a federal compliance component. This was something that was discovered in the Senate side. This is a policy option for the committee to consider. And, you know, given the severity of many of the infractions within the bill, it's definitely an issue for this committee to consider. But the severity of those dealing with those infractions is somewhat heavy-handed. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thanks.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jeff Stone from the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'll admit this bill makes my head hurt. I mean, he went through 14 sections, but the one that we are the one that we are concerned about is the same as the Oregon Farm Bureau. The only thing I would amplify is that a lot of our small growers would be impacted by this. Normally, it's a husband, wife, and perhaps their son who is the operator. So it does not excuse any bad choices that one would make, but I would just purely point out that it has a lot much larger impact than it may already occur, and it is a policy choice by you. We did talk about this on the other side with ODOT and Senator Metzger. Obviously we could not get it to the place that we could fully come here and support the bill in its entirety, but we just wanted to raise these issues for you on the record.
Thank you. Representative Widener, Edwards, Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So obviously Section 2 is where you have issues, and with the what is the law right now as far as a DU? Can a guy not have a driver's license and still drive one of the vehicles?
Under current law, you would either hold a Class C or a Class CDL license, and you would have your endorsement attached to that. So current law for CDL holders that have the farm endorsement, it would be exactly what this bill purports to do. You would have that. If you're holding a Class C driver's license, you would still fall under that 0.04 10-year suspension, no diversion qualification, from my understanding. The difference would be between a Class C driver's license with a farm endorsement who, from my reading of the bill and the statute and understanding, they would still qualify under the 0.08 standard for Class C drivers license holders. And that might be something that ODOT could clarify.
I was just going to ask ODOT if they want to come up and join in case the committee has questions directly to you. Follow up.
So if it fell under the Class C driver's license with 0.08, and if the person had a CDL, they're obviously going to fall under the 0.04 anyway. Mm-hmm. But if it fell under the Class C driver's license with the endorsement 0.08, you would be okay with that if it was amended to read that?
I believe that from my reading of the bill that would be how the process would play out, and I wouldn't have a problem with that. If you're a CDL holder, I think that you have a higher standard of operational proficiency that you must demonstrate, and for the most part, that wouldn't affect many of our small operators. But perhaps I also would like some clarification from ODOT's interpretation of the section two, Representative.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our interpretation of this bill is that in section two, if the driver has a CDL and a farm endorsement and has two or more of the offenses that I described in 809-440, they would be subject to losing their farm endorsement. But if they have a farm endorsement and no CDL, it's the same as having a regular passenger vehicle, and you're going to be subject to the 0.08 BAC. So it's only if you have a farm endorsement and a CDL. Our view is if you are a CDL driver and you're convicted of two or more of those we consider fairly serious offenses, they should also lose their farm endorsement and not be able to get a hardship permit, which is what they today could obtain, and be back on the road driving just a few weeks later.
Okay. So I'm guessing that you're not sure that that's...
Madam Chair, from my reading of Section 2 of the bill, I would not interpret it that way. But if that is the intent of ODOT, perhaps that's a conversation we can have regarding that section and trying to get to a win-win.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Actually, my question was asked, so I'll pass.
Okay. And Representative Gilman.
Sean, I appreciate you bringing up the situation of diversion. When we passed the commercial driver's license upgrade 2 or 4 years ago, I was against it at that time. I think diversion is a very effective tool, and any idea of pushing this off on the whole farming community is ridiculous.
Any other questions down here? Yes. Representative Berger.
Yeah, my issue is brought up. I just wanted to make sure that I understood that ODOT was going to sit down with the farm people and see if we can get language in Section 2 that would be a win-win. Is that the proposal?
I would definitely.
Madam Chair, my reading is as the Farm Bureau's is of Section 2, if the way I read it. If I think some clarification is needed if it's interpreted the way ODOT's interpreting it.
Chair, by
so I would ask that they get together in this.
I'd be more than happy to facilitate that.
Thank you. And Tom, you're fine sitting down to make sure that we get the right clarification.
Yes, Madam Chair. We did it on the Senate side as well, with the working out language we thought would be acceptable. We can do the same here.
Actually, I think the Department
all right. Given that's all the comments I have and all the people I have signed up, thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and we'll probably see this back in one form or another. I didn't gavel it close. I'll go ahead. I have been here for this discussion, and it was not that much fun the first time around because, again, I think the federal rules are awfully strict, don't really give us much leeway, but we don't really have a lot of control over that. I just want, I understand that if we're going to have to go into this again, I want to make sure that we do it right and that I think DUIs are very serious. I don't have a problem with the different standards, but I don't want anyone to think that we want to let people off on these kind of behaviors. So I think we're gonna we'll get the language, make sure the language is right, or make sure we get the intent on the record when we go to move this forward. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually, with the Chair's indulgence, would like to make a comment about a different section of the bill, about Section 8 and the requirement that in order to receive commercial driver's license with hazardous material certification, that a person be a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident. I understand why this is in here. I understand the concerns, and I understand that we need to connect with federal law, but my comment is just sort of is a more general comment that there are many people that are here legally, that are paying taxes, that are working potentially in the future through a guest worker program, that aren't permanent residents. It takes a long time, and it's very difficult to become a permanent resident, and I am hesitant to enact any kinds of restrictions on people that have come here legally and are paying their taxes and want to work and contribute to the economy. That said, obviously, I'll support the bill. We need to do this, but I wanted to get that on the record.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, just to clarify, a Class C driver's license is just what an average person has. And what they're asking is that the farm endorsement be connected to the DUI law that's relative to the Class C, not to the commercial driver's license. So 0.08 rather than 0.04. That's someone, Madam Chair?
Yes.
That's someone with a regular Class C driver's license, correct? Because if you have a commercial driver's license, you better damn well be aware of what the law is, and I just have no sympathy for those that don't, because their livelihood depends on it. Especially, they should be even more cognizant of the law than those that just have. Although there's no excuse for those of us with Class C not to be as well. But I just wanted to make sure I knew what they wanted out there.
Thank you, and Tom. Sorry about this. I should have gaveled when I did. But on Representative Bailey's concerns, I wonder if you want to address the language so we have an idea.
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, it is compliance with the federal regulations. There's a hazmat check that must be done every 5 years. In Oregon, we do it every 4 years. We have an 8-year license. We do it right in the middle. So it's aligning that criminal background check with the hazmat endorsement. And that's a higher standard as far as the type of vehicle that's being operated there. And so we have put that in as permanent legal resident rather than temporary, just to align with the federal regs and set that standard.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Weidman.
And, Madam Chair, to follow up on Representative Bailey, what he described was somebody who was here legally. So, I mean, there's lots of people who went through the paperwork, have their green card, and they would be able to use this and get this endorsement. So there are some language barriers and stuff that we need to make sure we address with some of these chemicals, though, to make sure people understand them. And there are classes that they go through.
Representative.
And Madam Chair, I do understand why this particular requirement is in here, and we want to ensure that there's a higher standard for people who are handling hazardous material. Mm-hmm. I understand why the federal requirement was there. My comment was just a more general one that that we need to be cognizant of people who are here for temporary work permits or purposes, that people who are here for to become permanent residents, and it can take years to become a permanent resident. My wife went through that process, and I just want to ensure that we are not restricting people who are here, who want to work, who want to contribute, and want to pay their taxes from doing so. Again, I understand why this requirement is here, but as a general principle.
Thank you. And with that, I now am gaveling Senate Bill 129A closed. Yes, we are meeting on Wednesday, committee, but not Friday. Okay. We have floor Friday. Maybe, unless we get our work done really early.
I just had a Homer Simpson moment there, ma'am.
We are adjourned.